When I first joined the CIA nearly 35 years ago, the first thing friends and family members wanted to know was what I could tell them about UFOs, unidentified flying objects, space aliens, intelligent interstellar life and the like. I didn't know anything, of course. The job of the CIA is simply to recruit spies to steal secrets. But with that said, everybody, not just Americans, but everybody has an interest in whether there's intelligent life out there. Today, we'll try to get to the bottom of that question. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. After spending most of his life studying the night sky for signs of extraterrestrial life, Dr. Avi Loeb found something in 2023, something that shook the scientific community. Dr. Loeb carried out a $1.5 million expedition searching for signs of a mysterious meteor called IM-1 that crashed into the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Papua New Guinea in 2014 and is believed to have come from interstellar space. Dr. Loeb oversaw a team of deep sea explorers who found 850 tiny spherules or molten droplets using a magnetic sled that was dropped from the expedition vehicle 2 kilometers under the surface of the ocean. He believes that these objects, each about 0.5 millimeter in size, are most likely made of an unfamiliar material composition that is much stronger than the iron found in regular normal meteors. Further testing is ongoing, but Dr. Loeb believes that these spherules could have either originated in another galaxy or were created by intelligent life. We're happy to be joined today by Dr. Avi Loeb. He is the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University, where since 2007, he's been director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at the Center for Astrophysics. He chaired the Department of Astronomy at Harvard from 2011 to 2020, and he founded the Black Hole Initiative there in 2016. Dr. Avi Loeb, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say right at the start how much I enjoy speaking with you. You are always so full of new information, well-researched and documented information, and it's always so interesting. Let's start with this expedition to Papua New Guinea in 2023. How did you first learn about this meteor, and what made you confident that it was different enough and important enough to be investigated?
So I was interviewed on the radio, actually, about another meteor that landed near Kamchatka. And that was back in January 2020. I realized that by looking online that NASA compiles a catalog of meteors over the past decade. And I asked my student to look through those meteors and see if any of them was moving too fast to be bound to the solar system. And we found the one from January 8th, 2014, a decade ago, that was reported by sensors aboard the US government satellites. They saw the fireball that released about 1% of the Hiroshima atomic bomb energy. And this meteorite, this object, was moving not only faster than the escape speed relative to the sun, but also was moving faster than 95% of the stars in the vicinity of the sun relative to the so-called local standard of rest. It was moving at 60 kilometers per second. So that was very intriguing, and the U.S. Space Command confirmed this assessment. They went back to the data and wrote a letter to NASA saying, indeed, this one is interstellar in origin. And it was roughly 0.5 meter in size, collided with Earth, and exploded, according to the data, 20 kilometers above the surface of the Pacific Ocean, about 90 kilometers away from Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. And what was special about that is, at the same speed as it was moving, there was, for example, another meteor discovered a few months ago over Spain and Portugal. And that one exploded at 70 kilometers altitude, where the density of air is 1,000 times lower. And so this interstellar meteor from a decade ago was actually 1,000 times tougher than the one from a few months ago from the solar system. We know that because it was moving in an orbit that is definitely bound to the sun, came from the main asteroid belt, from an orbit near Jupiter. And so this interstellar meteor was not only very fast, but it had material strength that was tougher than even iron meteorites, the toughest meteorites that we had witnessed before that were in the NASA catalog. And so that drew my attention because I wanted to know whether it could be artificial in origin. Just imagine the Tesla Roadster car that was launched by Elon Musk in 2018 as a dummy payload on the Falcon Heavy rocket. It's now on an elliptic orbit around the sun, and maybe in 20 million years it might collide with Earth based on calculations, and it would appear as an object of unusual material strength. The engine of such a car would survive the re-entry. An interesting question is, are there interstellar cars of this type? Is Elon Musk the most accomplished space entrepreneur since the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago? You know, there is a chance that there is a lot of space trash out there, and maybe this meteor represents one of them. And so that's why I decided to lead an expedition to look for the materials of this object. And we went there, and we collected materials, and we studied them over the past year, and I can give you more information about what we found.
Let's take those possibilities separately. If the spherules that you recovered off the coast of Papua New Guinea were interstellar, that is, they came from another galaxy, another solar system, why is that so important? And if they are interstellar, what does that do to the body of science that we have currently?
Yeah, so that finding a partner in our cosmic neighborhood would be as important as finding a partner in our private life. We know that it gives a meaning to our existence. It gives a new perspective on why we are here and what we are aiming to do. And, you know, cosmologists very often say the universe is pointless. That's what the Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg said at the end of his book, The First 3 Minutes. And my point is that we do see the universe as pointless. And in fact, Enrico Fermi said, "Where is everybody?" You know, that's the point of view of a lonely person. But if we find a partner, if we realize we are not alone, we're not at the intellectual center of the universe, there is a neighbor, and that neighbor may actually be smarter than us, and we can learn from that neighbor. You know, then we will get a new alignment of our goals, because as of now, we just focus on what happens on Earth, but that would perhaps inspire us to do better and go to interstellar space. It could also be a neighbor that we admire in terms of science and technology, that was able to accomplish far more than we did. And altogether, maybe it will convince us to stop investing in conflicts on Earth, which is just a tiny rock left over from the formation of the sun. It will give us a bigger perspective. So finding a partner, finding another civilization out there, is of great importance for the future of humanity. I see it as a shock therapy to humanity. Instead of being engaged in military conflicts, perhaps we'll have a new perspective on what we want to do, what we want to accomplish. And that's why I work on it, because just waiting for our leaders to serve as good role models for us is not a good approach. There is a lot of room for improvement in terms of the qualities of our leaders. It may be much better to discover sort of a messianic message for peace and prosperity from another star. That's my hope. So that's why I think it's so important. But of course, it could be down to a piece of trash. You know, like we would find trash from another civilization that is not functioning anymore. But their trash would be our treasure, because it would mean that we are not alone and there is someone out there. And it would be the most important scientific discovery ever in human history. And of course, in order to find it, we have to put resources to get the evidence. And only over the past decade, since that meteor that we discussed, only over that decade, we started detecting objects from outside the solar system. And there wasn't much investment of funds. I'm actually leading the Galileo project, which is funded by private donations. And it's the first scientific project aiming to study those interstellar objects and look for technological gadgets among them. And so that's why it's so important. And what we found in the Pacific Ocean are 850 molten droplets, out of which a tenth had a chemical composition that was never reported before in the scientific literature. It had enhancements in elements like beryllium, lanthanum, uranium by up to a factor of 1,000 relative to solar system materials. And so we are suggesting that maybe we recovered, for the first time in history, material from a big object that came from outside the solar system. And we hope to do another expedition to look for bigger pieces of this object that will tell us its nature.
Many of the media articles that were published at the time of your discovery said that the spherules you found could even have come from an alien spacecraft. I've seen photos of these spherules, and they don't look like anything I've ever seen before. They're clearly metallic, and they consist of different colors. Is the spacecraft idea a possibility? Could this be a tiny bit of a spacecraft?
Well, in principle, it could, but what we found is just molten droplets. So what it means is that with the immense heat that was liberated, about 1% of the Hiroshima atomic bomb energy, some elements were lost in the explosion. These are called volatile elements. And the droplets that we found are lacking those elements. So we don't have the full census of the composition of the original object because we just found those molten droplets left behind. If we find a bigger piece, not only it will tell us the full composition of the object, perhaps the nature of the object, because we can tell if it's a rock or some alloy that was artificially produced. It would also allow us to date the age of the material because we could find enough isotopes, radioactive isotopes, that we can use as clocks to tell us the age or the duration of the journey. And moreover, we could study the material strength directly in the laboratory and the thermal conduction of this material. And if indeed it's a material much tougher than any other rock that we are familiar with from the solar system, the question is why, and it can the knowledge be used, for example, to develop a new shield for Starship? Again, SpaceX is having challenges protecting Starship, and perhaps either nature or another civilization could help us figure out the better materials that were not recognized before.
Thank you, Dr. Loeb. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Avi Loeb about the possibilities of and the evidence for alien life. Stay tuned.
In the 1870s, the colonial expansion of the British Empire in the Nile Valley increased. The British decided to get complete control over Sudan. However, the deeply religious people of that country did not want to obey foreign laws. The unceremonious intervention of British officials led to people's discontent. Its spokesman was the theologian Muhammad Ahmad, who proclaimed himself the Mahdi, the Messiah. He began to gather an army against the invaders. By 1884, most of the Sudanese cities were in the hands of the Mahdists. Great Britain decided to intervene directly, but the troops of Ahmad gave the invaders a drubbing. In 1885, the rebels took the capital, Khartoum. The defeat of Britain was total. Only by the very end of the 19th century, after the death of Ahmad, the British were able to regain their control of Sudan. Unable to defeat the living Mahdi, the British took revenge on the dead one. His remains were drawn out of the mausoleum and thrown away into the Nile. Ahmad's head was brought to England as a trophy. However, the victory of the Mahdist revolt became the first successful action of the peoples of Africa against the colonial oppression and remained a dark stain on the reputation of the British Empire.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Dr. Avi Loeb. He's the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University, where since 2007 he has been director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at the Center for Astrophysics. He chaired the Department of Astronomy at Harvard from 2011 to 2020, and he founded the Black Hole Initiative there in 2016. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Loeb, you have been stymied several times by other astrophysicists and even by the American government, which would not give you access to classified information that would have quickly proven your assertions about IM-1. Still, you were able to calculate that IM-1 with 99.999% certainty that the meteor came from another galaxy. But then the U.S. Space Force confirmed to NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, that IM-1 was tougher materially than all other known space rocks. Your calculations were right. Was this Space Force and NASA determination helpful to you? And if so, in what way?
Well, it was very helpful because they had access to sensors that we don't have access to in the scientific community. So they went back to the data and confirmed what we said, most importantly, that this object came from outside the solar system, and not necessarily from another galaxy, but from within the Milky Way galaxy, our own. That will be the first object that was recognized as such by scientific data. And that was extremely important. It took them a few years. As usual, government is very slow, but I'm grateful for their support on that. Now, there were several people critics who tried to argue that they don't believe the U.S. government data. But in fact, the meteor over Spain and Portugal from a few months ago was also detected by the same satellites that the U.S. government owns. And that data was compared to ground-based data on that meteor. And the government data is very accurate, actually. And so someone actually posted a scientific paper just a couple of months ago saying, you know, the U.S. government data should be trusted on the meteor from 2014, because, if you just look at how well they do relative to ground-based public data, it seems like they're getting the answer right. And at the 94% confidence, that person said that we should believe the U.S. government data from 2014. And this is after a number of so-called experts on meteors were trying to argue that the U.S. Space Command doesn't really know what they are doing, that in fact the report included the velocity that was overestimated by a factor of 2 or 3, which is really a very bold claim.
You wrote a book that was published in 2021 called Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth, in which you argued that something called Oumuamua, a pancake-shaped space rock about the size of a football field that was visible to scientists for just 11 days in 2017, could only have been an interstellar technology built by intelligent life. What did you base your findings on, and have your conclusions changed at all over the last several years?
No, because as a scientist, I respond to data, and we just didn't get new data on this object. I would love to have more data. And in fact, I'm working on finding additional objects like it. Next year, in 2025, there will be new data coming from the Rubin Observatory in Chile that will employ a camera with 3.2 billion pixels, 1,000 times more pixels than in your cell phone camera. And it will survey the southern sky every 4 days. and we'll likely find many more objects like Oumuamua. So I'm really looking forward to the data from that observatory, and I am now developing the software with my postdocs to find new interstellar objects. So I'm in favor of getting as much data as possible. It's only those the adults in the room who know the answer in advance and say it's never aliens and it's never interesting, they are actually quite boring, these people. I would argue that anyone with curiosity is a real scientist, whereas people that know the answer in advance are not real scientists, because the important discoveries in science were never expected, and they were based on data, on experimental evidence. And of course, if you claim you know the answer in advance, you're not seeking data, you're not searching for that. You don't need data, you know the answer. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're not seeking the data. If you just say, I know the answer, I don't need data. And by the way, nobody should fund the search for this meteor, the search for other objects like Oumuamua. That's really a way of maintaining your ignorance. Oumuamua itself was very puzzling because it was roughly the size of a football field, 100 meters, based on its reflection of sunlight. And the amount of sunlight reflected from it changed by a factor of 10 as it was tumbling every 8 hours. So that meant that it has a very extreme shape, because the area that is on the sky reflecting sunlight towards us was changing by a factor of 10 as the object was spinning. And the best fit to the variation was that of a flat object, pancake-like. And moreover, this object was pushed away from the sun by some mysterious force without shedding any mass. There was no cometary evaporation that would act on it through the rocket effect. So the question was, what is pushing it? And I suggested it's just the reflection of sunlight, which we see. And for that, the object had to be very thin. And it could have been, I suggested, space trash, like a plastic bag, tumbling in the wind, or a surface layer of a bigger object that was torn apart, or a broken piece of a megastructure, like a Dyson sphere. A few years later, in September 2020, there was another object discovered by the same telescope in Hawaii that was given the name 2020 SO. And after 3 weeks, this object showed excess push away from the sun as a result of reflection of sunlight, and there was no cometary tail. And after 3 weeks, the astronomers realized, oh yeah, this one is actually a rocket booster that was launched in 1966 by NASA. And so here you have it, a technological object that had thin walls and was pushed by reflecting sunlight. So I just suggested that perhaps Oumuamua was another one not produced by us. But we just cannot observe it anymore because now it's much farther away and very dim. It's about 100 million times fainter than it was close to Earth. And so we just need to find more objects like it, and I hope we will in the coming years.
What are you working on these days at Harvard, and how much progress have you made on the study of the spherules? Have you come to any conclusions?
Yeah, so first, indeed, we analyzed the material at the spherules. We found about 80 of them that are of unusual material composition. We call them Belau-type spherules because they are enhanced in the abundance of beryllium, lanthanum, uranium. So we call them Belau. We are trying now to measure the isotopic composition of those, but they are less than a millimeter in size. They contain, tens of milligrams of material altogether, those spherules. So it's not enough material to do very detailed isotopic studies. And that's why we are aiming to go again to the meteor site and look for bigger pieces. And that will cost $6.5 million. So we are in the process of planning it. We have a ship already. We hope to go there in summer 2025, assuming that we will secure the funding. And I have some leads that make me optimistic that we will. Separate from that, the Galileo project that I'm leading constructed an observatory at Harvard University that is monitoring the sky 24/7. We're looking for unusual objects in the sky because the director of national intelligence submitted 3 reports to the US Congress stating that there are unidentified anomalous phenomena. And so we use the scientific approach to figure out if there are any objects from outside of Earth in the sky. And so far, we looked at 500,000 objects, a little more than that. We haven't seen anything anomalous as of yet. We are writing some papers describing the results. But we are also building 2 additional observatories, one in Colorado and the other one in Pennsylvania. And the hope is that over time, if we get more funding, we will have many more observatories. We know how to make them. Each of them costs less than $1 million. And if we get funded by anyone interested in having an observatory of this type, we can build it. And the hope is, you know, we will collect data on tens of millions of objects over the next few years, and we will get to the bottom of the question of whether there is anything extraterrestrial out there.
Dr. Loeb, when I was 17 years old, my father and I were driving through Amish country in western Pennsylvania one night just before midnight. It was very, very dark. The Amish don't use any electricity. And suddenly we saw a flash of bright white light. It was followed by a second flash and then a third. And immediately after that, an orange trapezoid lit up and it hovered in the near distance above us. We pulled over, got out of the car, and we just stared at it. It hovered there for about 30 seconds and it made no sound. And then suddenly it flew off at a fantastic speed, something I have never seen before or since. All these years later, I still have no idea what it was that I saw that night. What, an alien craft, a balloon of some sort? I have no idea. What is your opinion on UFOs or on what are now called UAVs, unidentified aerial vehicles? Are these things explainable? Are signs of alien life more likely to be found as tiny spherules in the Pacific Ocean?
Well, I think there are lots of human-made objects in the sky, natural objects in the sky. So the question is whether an unusual object of the type that you describe is one of them or something else. And when people say we have a lot of cameras looking at the sky, they are not professional, they're not scientific. And it's possible that 1 out of 1 million objects in the sky is of a very exotic nature. What you witnessed might have been one of those. And I was actually at dinner at CERN, where I delivered a public lecture, and there were 12 people around the table with a high net worth, and 2 of them reported about experiences very similar to the one you describe. And these are reliable people. They're very serious people. They just saw something that cannot be explained. And the objects that they saw were moving in ways that we cannot associate with human-made technologies. So I'm saying I'm very intrigued by those reports. Unfortunately, I don't have access to data from those reports, but that's why I'm leading the Galileo Project. I think we should hedge our bets and put billions of dollars into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And only if we don't find anything then, you could make the argument, perhaps we are alone. But without putting that effort, you know, it's just inappropriate scientifically to make the case that we might be alone.
Fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, John.
Almost everybody has a tale of the unexplained, of a UFO sighting. Even President Jimmy Carter reported seeing a UFO when he was the governor of Georgia. How exciting is it to know that there are professionals like Dr. Avi Loeb taking this issue so seriously and doing research that will give us the answers we seek and that will stand the test of time. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, for being with us today, and thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.